Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates, episode by episode, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Major Paul Wildenberger. Hi, Paul.
Oh, am I supposed to talk in this episode? I thought this is the one where you were just going to rattle on for about half an hour. I'll just yell out some random foreign words at you every now and then.
It was tempting to not do that for this episode, just have me talk for a half hour. But I've been accused of talking too much on my podcast lately, so I thought, no, let's have a guest for this one.
Oh, okay. Well, I appreciate it.
Well, welcome back. Thank you for coming back.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
So we're here to talk about, of course, season four. It's episode 18, Hawkeye. Original air date was January 13th, 1976. Written by Larry Gelbart and Simon Muntner and directed by Larry Gelbart. So, of course, Paul, you've been on the show a couple times before, so let's get right to the episode. On his way back from an aid station, Hawkeye almost hits some kids playing in the road. He swerves to avoid them, crashing his Jeep and hitting his head. Bleeding, and with the help of the kids, he staggers into a nearby hut populated by a Korean family. None of them understand a word of English, but Hawkeye keeps babbling, trying to keep himself awake. Sure that he has a concussion, Hawkeye writes a note for someone to come and get him, giving it to one of the kids, who will hopefully bring it to the 477th. In the meantime, Hawkeye keeps talking. He talks about his time in med school, a particularly stacked waitress he dated, great musicals he's seen, an old math teacher who had three nostrils, supposedly, and his life in Crabapple Cove. As he waits for someone to come and get him, he gets more worried about his concussion, and Hawkeye's thoughts turn more serious. He ponders about the war and the sheer awesomeness of the human body. He even does some juggling. Finally, as night begins to fall, he hears a Jeep outside. Radar has arrived, and Hawkeye grabs his stuff, thanks them all for their hospitality, and leaves. A few days later, Hawkeye returns with presents for the entire family, who are happy to see him, even offering him some dinner. All right, Paul, obviously, as we know, this is a format-busting episode, and that is it only features one cast member, which, of course, is Alan Alda as Hawkeye, making him the only cast member to appear in all 251 episodes of MASH. He mentions Radar, but we never see Radar. So this is it for the show. It's just Alan Alda. Before we get to the specifics, and this is going to be kind of a difficult episode to go through because, you know, we've been doing it scene by scene. Well, this episode really doesn't have scenes. It's just one long scene, basically. I mean, it's got some ebbs and flows to it. But overall, what do you think of this as a episode format, as the idea of taking one character and letting them just be center stage? I mean, do you think that's overall, would you have liked to have seen this done for other shows, other episodes of MASH? What do you think of that as a conceit?
I did like this episode quite a bit. I think the format of having just a single character can be done, but I don't want to see it a whole lot. In this case, you know, it would have been fine to see an episode of a later episode of MASH with a single character, or maybe broken up into segments where BJ is by himself in one segment, Potter's by himself, something like that. I don't think they could do this very often. I think Hawkeye is really the only one they could pull off a whole episode for.
Well, Sam, I was going to ask you about that. So you think that the only way they could have – I mean, it makes sense that once they came up with this notion – and, of course, I don't know who came up with it. I'm going to assume it was Larry Gelbart, but I don't know that for sure – that once they came up with the idea of let's give one character the whole episode, the natural selection would be Hawkeye because he's your main – he's your first among equals of characters. That said, it might have been kind of interesting to do this with BJ. Or Colonel Potter, like getting to know him. But of course, Hawkeye of all the characters is the most kind of given to like babbling, you know, talking wildly. So it's like you couldn't necessarily, I don't know, I can't picture Colonel Potter talking endlessly to a bunch of Korean locals. Like I can't picture that.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. I think Alan Alda's performance as Hawkeye, someone who can just keep that going, you know, always on the go, always has something to say. And the whole notion of the fact that he has a concussion, he's trying to keep himself awake, helps keep the story rolling.
Right. Yeah. It would have been neat to try the other characters, but yeah. And you're right. Even if they had said, oh, this was successful, let's try this with, you know, Klinger. You couldn't do it too many times. You really, you know, it would get a little like, all right, is every character going to get, you know, one time around all by themselves? So, yeah, it is natural. I do wonder, though, like what the other actors thought of this when they get, you know.
I know.
Some actors are you know, there's a reason you get into acting is because you want to be seen. It's not, you're not a wallflower. At the same time, there are probably other actors that are like, hey, I got paid for the week and I didn't have to do anything. It's great. I'll see you guys next week. You know?
That's right. My name was in the title card. I'm good.
Yeah. I still get the union insists that I get paid for my episode. Right. So whatever. But yeah, you got to wonder, did this, I mean, everyone knew coming into the show, especially by the fourth season, that Hawkeye, as I said, is sort of the first among equals of the characters. But this really kind of says it.
Oh,
is that we're going to give the whole episode.
They named it Hawkeye. Come on.
Yeah, they named it Hawkeye. I mean, they could, it's right there, throwing it right over the plate, as it were. So, all right. So we're going to try and break this down a little bit. Again, it's hard because it is just pretty much a speech. I do want to mention right at the top, let's talk about the actors that he's going to be interacting with. We see them all at the very beginning, which is this Korean family. There's six people. There's a father, a mother, an oldest daughter who is pregnant, which will come into play across the episode. And then there's three smaller children. The father is played by Philip Ahn. He died in 1978. This is his first of three MASHes. He would also appear on shows like Wonder Woman, Police Woman, Kung Fu, Hawaii Five-0. Playing the mother is Shizuko Hoshi. This is her second of four MASHes. Her big claim to fame, in terms of MASH at least, is that she played Rosie. She was the first actress to play Rosie in the season three episode Mad Dogs and Servicemen. They would later recast the role actually a couple of different times. But nevertheless, she was the first actress to play it. The young woman playing the pregnant daughter is June Kyoto Liu. She's had really quite a remarkable career. She actually has a movie credit in 2020. She was in movies like Big Trouble in Little China, Bloodwork with Clint Eastwood, and Lady in the Water, the M. Night Shyamalan movie. So she's done quite well for herself. This is the first of four MASHes she would do. And then the three children, Susan Sakimoto and Jeff Osaka. This is their only credit. This is one episode of MASH. And then the other younger boy, Jaylene Sun. He only has one acting credit, which is this episode, but he has an extensive stunt work resume. He's done stunts for movies like True Lies, Dead Again, and Batman Forever. So I wonder how you end up going from one episode of MASH to stunt work in this kinds of big ticket movies. But nevertheless, those are going to be the actors that Alan Alda is going to be dealing with throughout this episode. And I thought it was, again, a nice conceit that, of course, none of them speak English, which is a nice way to just keep Hawkeye babbling the whole time.
And I wonder how that works for the other actors. If they're speaking a foreign language, do they get paid the same as non-speaking roles or speaking roles?
I'm guessing you get paid the same. I think the rule is anything over three lines, at least it used to be, then that knocks you up. So I think it doesn't matter what language you're speaking.
Good.
You're speaking on camera, you get paid. That's the
I hear your voice, you get paid for it.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So we know that Hawkeye is obviously very nervous because he starts, you know, kind of babbling. He already starts talking about Doris Day and he starts singing a song. The youngest daughter or the oldest daughter hands him a bowl of water and he says, thank you. But the water here is so full of germs, you could sell it by the slice. And he puts it away and you can see that they're kind of the daughter is looking a little confused and the father kind of like tells her to shush it away. Clearly, they're kind of like insulted a little bit, but
yeah.
They just sort of roll with it. So Hawkeye writes this note. Saying, you know, come get me. And he mentions that the camp is in Weijongbu, 20 miles away.
Yeah.
And they hand it to the youngest child. How long is that kid going to take to get there? 20 miles?
I actually had to look that up. I Googled it. I said, how long does it take to go 20 miles? And they said, if you're walking at a brisk pace, at least 4 hours.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. that's a good hike there for that little girl.
Yeah, that's a right. It's the little girl that goes. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense because by the time we see Hawkeye get picked up, it is night, so it does make sense. But man, yeah, letting your young child walk in war torn Korea for 4 hours, that doesn't seem you know. And then I like when they kind of act like they know where to go. And then the father goes, Wu Zhang Bu? Like, he's almost like he's never heard of it before. And Hawkeye has that, oh, great. You know? Yeah. He's just, oh, geez. Okay. All right. I have no idea what's going to happen here. So one of the things I found interesting about this whole episode is all of it is about Hawkeye's past. At no point in this 27 minutes of him just talking does he mention anyone at the 477th or even his life there. Right. It is all about his past. What did you think about that? Again, as a conceit, like, would you have liked to have heard him maybe start telling these people maybe some secrets about what it's like being at the 477th that obviously he doesn't, he realizes that no one else is going to know except the listeners, the viewers?
I don't know. That might have been done on purpose so that, yes, it is a Alan Alda only episode, but if we keep talking about the other characters, then the fact that they're not there maybe just kind of draws that back to your attention as opposed to just focusing on the character we do have.
That's an interesting idea. I could see that. Yeah, right. If he keeps talking about BJ and Colonel Potter, you're like, well, where are they? When are they going to show up? That's true. If he's always talking about his – this, I mean, this is by far – we've heard a lot of stories from Hawkeye about his past and with those letters to his father and talking about Crabapple Cove. But obviously, this is the most we're ever going to get from him, hearing about his life and what's important to him and stuff. He talks about, you know, football player. He talks about a football player. He talks about his teacher, as I mentioned, the one with the math teacher who supposedly had three nostrils because he thought it was symmetrical or something like that. And then he talks about great meals that he's had. And one of the things that they've suggested with Hawkeye over the years is that he's like a particular kind of gourmand, is that he gets a lot of delight out of great meals that he's had, as opposed to saying like Radar. Radar, as he says, his taste buds are tone deaf. He just eats whatever junk is put in front of him. But Hawkeye, I think, has a very particular affection, almost romantic affectations about great meals that he's had. And by the way, he mentions this place where he had this whitefish, Sol and Sol's Deli. I looked that up. That's a real place.
No, really?
It's a real place in Englewood, New Jersey. Oh. And of course, Alan Alda is from New Jersey. And he was from around that area. So, I mean, it's probably maybe something from his real life. So, Paul, I want to ask you, do you have really fond memories of like a particularly great meal that you've had at some point in your life? Do you think like that? Do you have those kinds of memories?
I've had some really good meals. I don't think I have the same affection, recollection. It doesn't, if I say back, well, I know this one time I had this really good steak. Mm. Where was it? I couldn't tell you. I just remember it was really good. Yeah. So how about you, Rob?
Yeah. I will say I've said this on, I think, other episodes over the time of the different it's not so much the food because I don't think that my taste buds are terribly sophisticated. But frequent MASH cast guest Corey Drew, who used to run a bed and breakfast and really knows about food, said that my tastes are running the sort of the pub style food. And I think that's probably accurate. But I can remember a bunch of years ago, I was out in California for a work trip and I had some time to kill. Before I was going to have lunch with a friend and I had some time to kill. And, I was walking down, we were down in Santa Monica, which was beautiful. And I was walking down this sort of, just like this market where all these different places, all these different restaurants are open. And there was an Auntie Anne's Pretzels, which of course is a chain, it's a franchise, but, I love soft pretzels. That's like one of my favorite. And I had time to kill. So I went and got a pretzel and I sat on the curb and just baked in the gorgeousness of California while I sat there and ate this pretzel and drank some lemonade. And like, right. I thought about it and I'm like, I realize this is a pretzel from a franchise that you can get any other place, but this is the best meal I've ever had.
That was more the setting than the
Yeah, exactly.
The
it was, oh, okay. It's not no, so I get the that. Meal. Right. I mean, I've had some great food in my life, but it really is more the situation than it is the food. Like you, I don't think – I'm kind of the reverse. I'd be able to tell you where I had these things, but right. not how good the food was. Okay. You know, I'd be like, I don't know. Was that – it was pretty good food. Like a couple of years ago, we were at the Boston Comic Con, and it was me and Ryan Daly and Shag and Dr. Ange and the aforementioned Corey and the Sutherlands, a bunch of the podcast – Tim Price, a bunch of the podcasting crew. And we had this wonderful dinner looking out over the water in this gorgeous sort of summer night. And I'm like, that's one of the best meals I ever had. I can't tell you what I ate.
Right. It was the company you kept.
It was the company. It was that kind of thing. So. But Hawkeye, I mean, obviously Hawkeye sends all the way to Korea to get ribs. So obviously he's very, very big on, on these meals. So he starts again, he reflects, at one point he starts talking to the daughter who he mentions that, of course the daughter is pregnant, and he has made a joke about, you know, we know what causes that these days. And we know what's happened. And he talks about how girls were Martians, about growing up when he was a kid, that Franklin Roosevelt was always the president. Paul Muni played everybody. This is 1951-ish.
Right.
Right? How old do you think Hawkeye is? How old do you think they're saying as a character? We can guess that Alan Alda is playing younger, but how old do you think MASH is suggesting Hawkeye is here?
I imagine he was in his early 30s.
I always figured that as well.
Yeah.
Even though he's starting to get gray.
Yeah. Bit. War will do that to you.
Well, that's true. Yeah, there you go. So okay. So this is like 1951. Let's say he's 31 at this point, which means he's born in 1920, which means Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president from when Hawkeye was 13 till Hawkeye was about 24. And like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. That yeah, that would be when you're that age, impressionable in age. And I will say, like, the first president that I can think of really being aware – that I was really aware of was Ronald Reagan, because I was 9 when Ronald Reagan came into office. And in a weird way, when I think of presidents, that's the one I think of the most, because that was the one that was president during the years that I started noticing such things.
Yeah.
You know?
Good point, yeah.
Yeah. So it makes total sense that the Hawkeye thinks of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in that way. So then he gets bored at one point after talking, and he wanders outside to talk to the ox. And the scene where he talks to the ox, this scene was always cut in syndication. I never saw this scene until I got the DVDs.
Right.
So I like that. I always wonder, too, where like, in terms of production, where do you get these things? Like, where do you get an ox like that? You know what I mean? Like, you know, I mean, I know that 20th Century Fox was still a very huge studio at this point, and they were still making tons of movies, so you could just get, but I just kind of like that idea of like, well, what do we need for this? Well, we need a hut set, and we need a Jeep that we can crash, and oh yeah, we need a gigantic ox that we're gonna roll we're gonna drag out to the set. Right. And of course this scene is the only scene well, other than when they crash, but these are the only two scenes we see outside. Everything else is just done on the set, but we can tell they're really out on the lot, because you can see sort of the natural sunlight. And I like this scene with the ox, because actually this is the one where you can see Hawkeye's worry is really ramping up. Like, he's really getting concerned that he might die from this.
Right. Of course, you wonder how bad was he hurt? How bad was the concussion? Because hasn't been but a matter of minutes. And he's like, they should be here by now.
Yeah.
How fast do you think that little girl is?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. What, the kid would order an Uber or something? Okay. I mean, come on. You know what you gotta do. That's true. Yeah. He might not be perceiving, how fast time is going.
Have you ever had a concussion, Rob? Sorry to interrupt.
No. No.
I know a few episodes back you said you'd never broken a bone, but I've never broken a bone.
No, I've never had. Have you been lucky enough to never have a concussion?
I had one about 6 years ago.
Oh.
Yeah. I was. So. I was out there at the local park with my friends, throwing a frisbee around. And, you know, I've done that hundreds of times. But for some reason, this time when I stepped on a wet patch of grass, I went straight back and thankfully I hit my back first, but my head did hit pretty hard.
Ouch.
Yeah, so that was – yeah. So for a few days, I had a hard time concentrating. My short-term memory wasn't very good, or at least I don't think it was.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was disoriented for a few days. That was interesting.
Did you go to the hospital?
Oh yes. Oh yes. You know, I didn't go right away.
Okay.
Because it wasn't until, you know, I hit and I got up and my friends checked on me and we kind of all, you know, said our goodbyes, and my wife was, you know, oh, are you okay? I said, well, my head is really hurting. So we went to the ER and had it checked out.
What do you remember what they told you to do? Because I always heard the thing about that if you have a concussion or you think you do, don't fall asleep. Like that's right. And then, of course, that's the thing you think to do because you think you want to run to rest.
Right.
But I've been told that you shouldn't do that because it could really set the problem kind of deeper in. So they, do you remember what they told you?
I don't remember everything, but what I do recall is that they asked how long ago it was. They kept me for observation for a while just to make sure I wasn't going to lose consciousness or things like that. Up 3 days before I really felt back to myself.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's scary. That's real scary.
Yeah. I didn't crest a Jeep to avoid the kids. But no, it was worrisome. Let's put it that way.
Frisbees are dangerous. You got to be really careful.
Those things will kill you.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So, So again, night has fallen. Hawkeye starts talking about some great plays that he has seen, some theater, and of course, Alan Alda has had a very long career in live theater as well. I'm not that familiar with how many musicals he might have done. He sings, Alan Alda as Hawkeye sings badly well, if that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Like when he does it, he does that, "Now won't you have found her?" And it's bad, but it's entertainingly bad.
Right. I was very impressed with his range.
Yeah, he gets pretty deep. He gets, he is pretty deep. He talks about some turkeys that he has seen and, you know, what it's like. And of course, you know, this is Hawkeye growing up in the 1940s, 30s and 40s, and theater and the radio are the preeminent forms of entertainment. This is pre-television.
Right.
This is pre, you know, so theater is a big thing. I will say this about going to see plays. Have you seen a lot of live theater?
Oh yes.
Oh yeah.
The theater. Oh yeah. Mostly community theater. I was involved in a lot of shows. I've been in a number of shows for community theater, but I love going to see them. And I love, you know, just any live production is wonderful.
You've acted in plays?
Yeah, about 15, 20 over the years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. It's just as like a hobby, just something you just like to do.
Oh yeah. I don't get paid. They won't pay me to do it, but I've done a couple of musicals in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I tend not to do musicals for everyone's sake.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Do you sing poorly well as well?
Yes. I did a musical in college, in fact, where it was a musical and it was a show called Mystery of Edwin Drood.
Oh, I've heard of that.
See that. Yeah.
Yes,
so
yes.
It's the novel that Charles Dickens was writing when he passed away. So he never finished it. So they made a musical based on it. And so you get about 2/3 of the way through the musical. And then everyone in the company just stops mid-song saying, okay, well, this is where he laid down his pen and died. So the audience then has to vote on who they think the murderer was, who they think the detective in disguise was. So every night can be a little different. So that was a lot of fun. We had to learn like I think a dozen different endings, just to see how it went. And then at the end, they said, "Okay, now we need a happy ending. So we need a love interest. We need, we can't just end on someone getting arrested." So they took the remaining male cast members, primary characters, and the remaining female characters, and then the audience by applause would pick who the love interest was for the males and the love interest for the females, and they would sing a little duet together. We did 4 productions of that in college. I was picked as the male love interest every time.
Hey, look at that.
Because I was the comic relief pretty much. And
okay.
It was a comedy musical mystery, but I was definitely, you know, the definitely a comic relief character. And so I was only I think 18 at the time, but I was playing a 14-year-old. So I said, "You know what? 14-year-old voices break." So I use that.
Oh, okay.
Especially when they're nervous. So
okay, I use
that to my advantage.
Very good. That's amazing. I've never been. I love the anonymity of the microphone here. The idea of being on stage is just utterly terrifying to me. That's amazing.
Right.
What was your favorite thing that you ever acted in?
I did a production of Harvey. You know the Jimmy Stewart movie.
Sure.
I played that role, Elwood P. Dowd. That's my favorite production yet. I did that back 1999, so it's been a while. But my wife, we'd only been married a year. She was in the show with me, so that was fun.
Very nice. That's really cool. Yeah, every time I have gone to see a play, and it has not been often, but every time I have gone, I've loved it. I love the energy of it, the excitement of it, of that you're seeing it live in front of you. And then I say to myself, oh, I really want to do that again. And then like 5 years passes before I do it again. Now, part of it is I tend to go on to see something on Broadway, which is profoundly expensive, which is part of the problem. Like I saw The Producers with Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane.
No, that's
and I mean, great. It cost me, you know. It like,
and I could afford to go to another one 5 years later.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, it was like I could have bought a car for what I paid. Now, I would not give up that experience for the world,
right?
Because it was such a unique. And in fact, the show. What are we talking about? We're talking about MASH, right? But there, the moment that we saw the night that we saw The Producers, there was a moment where clearly Nathan Lane forgot his lines, and everyone knew it, and so did Matthew Broderick, and Broderick refused to throw Nathan Lane a fishing line. So he was letting Lane twist in the wind, and that became even doubly funny.
Oh, that's
everyone
great.
Knew that Nathan Lane was just like, well, you know, and he kept vamping because he knew. And then when he finally got it, everybody burst into applause because they were just, and it was, you know, you're never going to see, you know, that's a once in a lifetime kind of thing. That's what's great about it. So, yeah. And it's funny that you say Harvey, because that's the last play I saw. They did
really?
A production. Yeah, they did a production of Harvey on Broadway with Jim Parsons from The Big Bang Theory.
Oh, I heard about that. Yes.
And it was very fun. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, that's something I want to do more of, but it's again, you know, 5 years past, I was like,
well,
I have $500 to spend on these tickets. So anyway, let's talk about MASH a little
bit. Yeah, speaking of plays,
I mean,
Lawrence Olivier,
this episode is really hard to sort of like summarize because it really is just Hawkeye talking. So later on, he does have a conversation. He talks about a stripper that he saw who had a parrot act. Where the parrot talked dirty, which is a funny thing. Now, of course, Alan Alda's father, the great Robert Alda, was in Burlesque, played in vaudeville.
Right.
And Alan Alda, in his biography, I think he's had at least two biographies at this point, has told stories about that he was like a five-year-old running around backstage with strippers, with burlesque queens, because that was the life that his father brought him in. So this was something he was familiar with. So that might be something a little drawn from Alan Alda's life of just being, you know, being around all that showbiz people and all that kind of stuff. And they never, throughout this episode, they never give you any sort of joke that any of the family really understands Hawkeye. That, you know, they never cop to that. But there is a moment where Hawkeye starts talking about the stripper, and he kind of, his voice gets kind of lower, and you might not know what he's saying in English, but they cut to Philip Ahn as the father, and he kind of rolls his eyes a little bit. And I think the father is sort of like, he doesn't literally understand what Hawkeye is talking about. So he's either sick of Hawkeye talking, or he can sense that Hawkeye is telling something slightly off color or dirty. And he's just kind of like, okay. Cause they're trying to eat a meal at that point.
Right. Yes.
And then Hawkeye quickly changes tacks and goes to talking about all the metatarsals in the hand and talking about what an amazing instrument the hand is. And there's a nice line in there where he talks about, the marvel of the human hand is. And then he says, for some reason, it's always people always seem to want to clench it into a fist, which I thought was a really nice, very Hawkeye-esque line to kind of talk about that. That, you know, he, as a doctor, he regards the human hand and what it can do and how it separates us from all the other creatures out there. And yet so many of us want to use it as an instrument of destruction and or at the very least pain. And that to me is that's Hawkeye. All right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That whole discussion he had. Talking about, you know, talking about the yeoman being pregnant and talks about life. And he gets very philosophical.
Yep.
It's almost a religious discussion that he's having, or monologue, I should say.
Well, he is someone who looks at medicine as more than just certainly more than a job. It's even more than a profession. It's a calling. Now, I imagine that's the case for a lot of people, but probably not all. you know, probably not all. And but Hawkeye really seems to regard it as kind of this, as you say, kind of in almost religious terms, like a holy kind of way. I mean, he even talks about in a later episode this season where he contrasts himself to someone who was going into advertising. And he says, I was training for medicine. And the way he says it is like, well, that's obviously of paramount importance as opposed to somebody just getting into to advertising. So this conversation has a nice ebb and flow to it, and that there's parts of him being very silly and he's singing songs poorly and talking about strippers. But then when he gets into the conversation about medicine, we see how important this is to him and how he does regard the human body in a kind of, again, like, you know, like it's just this more than the hand, just the idea of it is just this amazing thing. It's like a marvel. Again, it's like, I keep using the word holy, but I think that's kind of how he looks at it. And that's a nice, that's a nice touch for the character and completely in line with what we know about Ends at this point.
Right.
So then later on, again, it gets even later. And then he starts to get really worried that nobody's coming. And then we hear the Jeep honking. And he, of course, he runs outside and he looks out and he says, that's got to be radar. And of course, we never see radar, but you have to assume that it is radar.
Even starts yelling, radar, hold on. Before
he even says, radar, hold on. He knows it's radar.
I recognize him by the way he honked that horn.
Yeah. so then that's a really great detail. And then he's like, wait a minute. And they're all paying. And then that's the end of the main part of the episode. Right. And then, you know, obviously he's going to head back to the camp. And then the button on the in the scene is that he comes back and he says, I have returned in Korean. Which is funny. And he brings different treats for everybody. He brings food for the mother. He brings tobacco for the father. He brings a note to the pregnant daughter saying in Korean, saying to come to the 477th when she is ready to have the baby. Again, it's 20 miles away. I don't know how she's supposed to get there if she's experiencing contractions. And then he has a line to the kids, which I'll jump to it right now, which is my favorite joke of the episode, where he goes to the two smallest kids and he brings them treats and he brings them candy and comic books. And then he pauses and he goes, not very good for you. You better read the candy and eat the comic book. Which is...
And is it just me or is it kill you that you couldn't see what the comic books were?
Oh yeah, I know. I've been trying to find that for you. I have these episodes on multiple formats and I'm able to blow up the screen as big as my computer screen will allow me, and I still can't make out what those comic books are. It drives me nuts. I wonder if they're those copies of the Avengers.
Yeah, that's right.
That Hawkeye had, and Radar had, and Dear Ma. Yeah, exactly. Now, of course, you know, as a comic book reader, when I was a child, I kind of wasn't a big fan of that joke, that the idea that comic books are, you know, crap.
Right.
They're not meant for you. But you also have to, first of all, it's just a joke. Second of all, you have to remember, this is like 1951. Comic books were at their like low, like right around their lowest ebb at this point in terms of their cultural currency. I mean, this was pre-Frederick Wortham. That was a couple of years away. But nevertheless, comic books were really getting dragged in the popular culture. So maybe, you know, that was just the kind of thing of like, yeah, they're not great for you, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe Hawkeye was bringing like crime comics full of horrible vibes. Like he's getting these kids EC comics.
Or something. Oh my goodness.
Here, kids, here's some tales of some suspense stories and Tales from the Crypt or whatever. So, but that's my favorite joke of the episode is that read the candy and read the candy and eat the comic. That was funny. And then the whole episode ends on kind of a grim joke where he's tasting the stew and he says, meat, where'd you get meat? And then he goes, wait, where's the dog? And then you hear the dog bark and he goes, oh, okay.
Oh, good.
And,
I know
that that's a thing, but I still hate those jokes.
I know.
I'm a softie. I just don't like jokes about violence to animals in any way. But nevertheless, it's a kind of just a nice, silly way to end the episode. And overall, it's a nice show. Again, it's, as you said, is it something they could do a lot of? Probably not, but they were certainly still trying to expand the format of this show in season four.
Right.
Do you have a particular favorite line or joke from the show?
My favorite joke we already talked about, and it, you know, the whole thing about the, you know, Hawkeye mentions Weejaboo, and they're like, oh, Weejaboo. And then finally he's like, oh, she knows where Weejaboo is, right? Weejaboo?
Yeah.
Philip Ahn's delivery of that line, it's one word, but it's priceless. But now my favorite part is actually at the dinner table, not a joke. It's the whole thumb speech. Mm-hmm. That, you know, explaining the miracle of the thumb. That's always stuck with me. Ending with the juggling, which is probably one of the reasons why I taught myself to juggle when I was a kid.
Wow.
Yeah, I do basically what he does there. I don't do any major tricks, mm-hmm. but I thought that's, I have to learn to do that.
And so, it was that was the inspiration?
I think that's one of the biggest inspirations. There's other things, you know, like live performances. I saw somebody juggle, but seeing Hawkeye do it, you know, MASH was my favorite show, you know, even as a kid. So, you know, I wanted to do that.
That's amazing. How long did it take you to learn?
It probably took... I learned wrong first. Yeah, I learned like they do in cartoons, where they do it in a circle.
Okay.
As opposed to the back and forth.
Oh, right, yeah, right, right. Yeah. Okay.
And I actually got pretty good at that. But, you know, I was learning with my dad's golf balls in the living room. And I'm like, you know, I'm going to break that lamp. I better stop doing this. Yeah. So I went back and I saw this episode. And I saw some other people do it live. I'm like, oh, there's the way you're supposed to juggle. So... and it probably took me a few weeks to learn, and then it took me a few months to get good.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's real dedication.
Yeah.
I have to ask you, now that you've said it, on your actor's resume, do you have juggling as a special skill?
I do.
Right. Okay.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, not that many people know how to do it. So, okay.
That's right.
Have you ever had to utilize that in a role?
I did a dinner theater show a number of years ago where I juggled. It was very much audience interaction. It was dinner theater where we interact with the people in the sitting at the tables.
Sure, sure.
You act around them. And so that was one thing. I come along and I grab stuff off their, you know, I grab like if they had a bowl of fruit on the table, I grab some apples and start juggling. I said, you weren't going to eat this, were you? I actually did something with the Virginia Shakespeare Festival back when I was a teenager. Where I was in what they called the Mummers program, where they were doing the live shows, the professional actors were on stage, but I was, you know, I and a few other teenagers, you know, from my school, we would come and kind of warm up the crowd as they're coming into the theater. And that was one of the things I did. I juggled to entertain the crowd as they came in.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really remarkable.
Again, it was nothing, you know, I've jugglers, you know, who can do, you know, five, six, you know, falls in the air at a time, you know, you're doing all the behind the back stuff. I can do a few little tricks like that, but three is my limit.
Okay. Fair. That's still quite impressive. My goodness. Yeah. So there are two other things I wanted to mention about this episode before we wrap up. One was just a small detail, is that when he's talking to the ox, he goes on this whole run of movies that he mentions, mm-hmm. and he mentions the Oxbow incident, which featured Harry Morgan in the cast. So again, I love those kinds of things. I was, you know, it's like when you had such a legendary performer as part of your cast, and you get to mention these movies, and you're like, wow, this guy was in the movie that we're referencing, which is
right. Well, and if we're going to talk about someone who's in a movie, they talk about Philip Ahn, the father. He started acting in the 30s. One of his movies was The Good Earth. Which starred Paul Mooney.
Oh, he's
Paul
in
Mooney.
The Good Earth. Oh, yes. Okay. Right. They talked about that in Of Moose and Men. That's right.
Right. BJ mentioned it. You know, the Fresh Earth. I think it was Paul Mooney, right?
Yeah. Paul Mooney and Louise Reiner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Oh, I didn't notice that in his filmography. Right. That's marvelous.
I thought that was a nice little connection.
Yeah. That's cool. So the one other thing that this episode inspired in me is, as I was growing up watching the show, I've never considered myself a writer. I have written some fiction. I've mostly written reviews and nonfiction, but I've written some fiction in my life. And so I've dabbled in here and there, and I have never thought to try and write like a MASH spec script or MASH fiction. I'm sure it must exist out there. I've never looked for it.
Right.
But it must exist. The one ever idea I had for a MASH episode that they never produced was inspired by this episode. And it would be a riff on this episode. And the premise is, it opens up in Tokyo. And for some reason that we will learn later on, Hawkeye and Frank Burns have been arrested.
Oh.
Hawkeye and Frank are in this jail cell. and they're stuck there overnight until Colonel Potter or Radar probably can come get them out. And I never figured out why they were in the jail cell. There's some trumped up reason, some mistaken identity lands them in prison. But it's the whole episode is just Hawkeye and Frank. And that's the episode where we really learn the most about Frank Burns.
Oh, wow.
Like, we learn deep, dark secrets, and Hawkeye comes out of that experience with a better understanding of why Frank is the way he is. I thought that would be a really interesting way of learning about Frank Burns and just giving Hawkeye just to be the only person. Or maybe BJ. It didn't even have to be Hawkeye.
Right.
But that's the conceit, is that for some reason, two members of our MASH unit, Burns and either Hawkeye or BJ, are stuck in the jail with him overnight. That's the basic idea I had. I never developed it past that initial story pitch, and I never will because I just don't have the interest to sit and write it. But nevertheless, my one idea was inspired by this episode. Right. So at the very least, there's that. So thank you, Hawkeye. That's going to do it for this episode. It's a very unique show. Mm-hmm. Not all experiments necessarily would be repeated throughout the history of MASH, but this is a fine episode. It's a nice try, I would give it. Right. Maybe it's not something, again, they want to go on and do later on, but nevertheless, it's an interesting idea. So, Paul, well, thank you once again for coming on and telling us so much about your personal life. I don't think that was necessarily something you anticipated, but that's where the conversation went.
I was inspired by Hawkeye's talking about his past.
Absolutely. So, again, thank you so much for doing the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rob. Anytime.
All right. So, of course, if you want to find back episodes of this show, just go to our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to MASHcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Amazon Music. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FWPodcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Britt Schramm, Mike Thomas, and Michael Porter. Their support of MASHcast. I very much appreciate it. So that is going to do it. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
I guess you never saw that movie, huh? You probably never see any. You really ought to, you know. There have been some great Ox movies. The Oxbow Incident. The Yank at Oxford. The Wizard of Ox. Cal Green was my valley. No, that's cheating.